coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this very special pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. I am out on the road right now with clients, but as always, we are bringing you new content, new episodes. Tonight, in the first segment, we have the pleasure of being joined by our good friend Keith Seeland. He is the author of The Humaniverse Guide. He is working on some new books as well. Welcome back to the show, Keith Seeland. How are you doing today?
Hi, real good, Chris. Thank you for having me. How's it going?
Doing fantastic.
As we wane through summer.
Oh, man. Summer actively flew by. It was really nice. It's a slow season in my industry, so the faster it goes by, the better it is for me. I was happy awesome. That we turned around and it was school time again. So we're I'm slammed right now, traveling all over the place. It's great. Thank you so much for taking the time to come back on, as always, with new information and new research. We've had you on numerous times talking about the concept of the Humaniverse, the idea of, is humanity ready for the cosmic conversation? Are we not only prepared ourselves, but would the rest of the universe see us as prepared for this conversation? You know, what got you into this realm of research to begin with, Keith?
Fascination with people, anthropology, nature, how things tick, so to speak, you know, all the science aspects of it, but having to do with the extraterrestrial concept, the ET idea. That was a life that's been pretty much of a lifelong fascination interest. My father, how it started as a toddler. My father flew in World War II. He flew a B-17, and he was fortunate to have a handful of sorties, incidences with what were then known as the Foo Fighters.
Oh, wow.
So it's, yeah. So his crew then, the Allies thought it was Nazi technology and vice versa, and there was never any progress or insight created on any of those dimensions. So, but they all knew the intuition was always there, and with my father also, that they knew that it's just there was things that just didn't add up, that this could be human-based or human-influenced or constructed or whatever. So now as a toddler, 4 or 5 year old, you know, I'm sitting there looking, as any child would look up to their parent as, you know, their idol, their hero, so to speak, and him telling the stories about the Foo Fighters and that. So wow. That sparked a lifelong interest of myself. You know, as time went on, going through education and then getting jobs and, you know, the workaday life that we all have to put up with, that was kind of those ideas, the grandiose ET concept and future was kind of put on a back shelf, day-to-day roles and life and everything. But I always still kept up in new studies, new interests. And as time went on, it the whole body of evidence and the nature and the controversial nature of the progress and the proliferation of this, it all just kept building and building and building and building in society. And I just kind of eventually, when finally got some more time in my life, started making a new pursuit into anthropology, archaeology, the study of human beings and the UFO, the ET phenomenon. Hopefully to try and give or offer some insights, some knowledge, whatever, however much that I can, to society. In we have to, in preparing for our future, we kind of have to also deal with the present. And I think that's where I want to circle back, touch on your point, that your question, are we ready for future and whatnot? Yeah. And the more I get into this, and the more I'm kind of suspecting that we may not be, as a species, totally ready for future life with other intelligences. Yeah. It's still, how will I put this? There's a concept called anthropocentrism. Human beings are the top of the food chain, figuratively, literally in some cases too. And it's still is very, very difficult for many in our society to, it's a Copernican concept, you know, where, we're being, the earth was the center of the universe in recent ancient times. And then that got eroded, and now what our psyche is being attacked to the point where it's being suggested that as a species, as biology, as life, intelligent life, we may not be the center of much of anything anymore anyways. So it's yeah, it's all damaging to our psyche, and maybe that plays into why there's the denial aspect of still big segments of our society,
sure,
that are not willing to even examine or acknowledge a lot of the evidence that's been built up throughout the millennia in terms of human beings and their experiences and whatever physical evidence has been left from other intelligences, not from planet Earth. So it's a conundrum for sure. Hopefully, I am in the middle of a manuscript right now, which will hopefully offer some insights. I think that maybe a best way for us to bring us up to speed into the present is to take a deep dive into our past. Now, we know that certain analogs, such as in the ET subject and disclosure and government secrecy and whatnot, we kind of know it's like, again, not learning from our past, from each episode, yeah, of the government will throw a bone and then disclosure doesn't happen. Well, this just happened a couple of years ago is another, yeah, iteration of the whole thing. So we know that human beings are not going to, we know that governments are not going to disclose. They'll go down kicking and screaming and the whole bit. We can't reasonably expect or predict that ET will just come down and introduce themselves the day the Earth stood still, experience, things like that. So in offering the possibility for us to obtain knowledge, enough knowledge about preparing us for a present and a future with ET, what best analog do we have as an archive of knowledge but to look back on our ancestors?
Yeah.
And see and learn what makes human beings tick. And in a very, very extremely pragmatic and practical sense, in a biological, and the thrust of my writing is going to be It's going to be psychology, archaeology. We're throwing in a lot of the social and natural sciences. It's a multidisciplinary effort, and that's where I've always advocated that in preparing a plan for ET's acceptance into our global consciousness. It has to be a multidisciplinary effort. It can't be just the government. And you and me already know that the government's been probably has plans of action for this forever. But there's been really no comprehensive plan even discussed in society. There's efforts at the colonization or the business, the economics of space and whatnot, but the relationships with other life forms hasn't really been offered. And it can't be just government. It can't be just certain select scientific research fields or whatever. It has to be multidisciplinary because we're dealing with other life. And it's other intelligent life. And I'm sure they have other aspects to their life. We have our science, empirical thought and knowledge. We have philosophy. We have a theology.
Yep.
We have an artistic bent. And these things are all hardwired into our brain, into our evolution. So contributions from all of these and from business, from economics, natural resources and things like that. It has to be all of a multidisciplinary effort. So I've long advocated for that, but that's just one aspect of tying together a whole program of learning who we are, who we came from, how we are now, and maybe then paving a road for the ET. And I'll also bring into the non-intelligent life forms in terms of what our future is going to be, because there's been no announcement on that either. I mean, as far as we know, other amoebas don't exist.
As much as I kind of hate saying it, Keith, what we need is a direction of the dialogue, you know? The idea of how do we as humanity represent humanity to another species? You know, how do we represent each other collectively when we can't even get along collectively to figure out what kind of pizza to order for everybody at the UN? You know, quite literally, that's the issue before us. And how do we, and that's, I think that's kind of a big starting point of conversation there, Keith, is the idea that anthropomorphization, the idea that, we tend to anthropomorphize things that we are studying. We tend to anthropomorphize things when we think about them philosophically. We tend to put them in a humanistic point of view. The prime example is I was in a conversation thread a few months ago, and granted, it was about Sasquatch. All right. But people started going off about how the Sasquatch had attacked some people and the evil things that this Sasquatch did. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. Who's evil are we judging a Sasquatch by now?
What we know
as evil is something that is a moral imperative to us. We don't necessarily know that it's a moral imperative to a Sasquatch. We don't necessarily know that invasively taking somebody from their bedroom without their permission isn't an average everyday thing in the world of an alien civilization that's kidnapping people. To us, it's a violation. Is it to them morally? We don't know, you know? So we have to be willing to admit that. And we have to be willing to say, like, we've got to be ready for that hard part of the conversation.
Oh yeah, our thought process, and this is you know, a learning point, Chris. In hopefully my writing that hopefully it'll be published next year, but our intellect is guided by analog, and I mean we the only substantial informative analog that we have is the one of human beings, how our minds were, how we became our species, Homo sapiens sapien, and go back one or two Genesis, the last couple of few hundred thousand years, how the human mind became aware, and how they in and it can be broken down, I think, into a very good. This is another very beneficial aspect of the scientific methodology, where you've got a step by step procedure of observation, then questions pop up, and then more pop up, more observations. You develop a hypothesis, you can study and analyze it. And in the emergence of the human mind, the human being, this can be shown to be hardwired into our brains, in that when you take the human brain on a very general, I won't get into all the medical six syllable concepts and things like that, but our brain is structured. We have a core instinctive part of our brain that's connected to our basic neurology that was naturally selected and evolved over millions of years. But that's our core instinctive brain center that's present in all animal life. I mean, the instincts for, finding food, water, which is, again, amongst our most basic instincts, reproduction is the other one. And the animal lives and species that have proliferated and have evolved and have continued to exist, haven't gone extinct. They were selected for those evolutions and achievements and whatnot. So any animal that has an instinct will have this basic brain core. What is setting human beings apart is the evolutionary processes, to where we grew physiological lobes or additional brain centers that allowed our executive center, our limbic system, our behavioral emotional centers and whatnot, and our artistic brain centers also. That was all evolved into us, to where we became special, maybe that's where all the anthropomorphism actually came from, and we can compare ourselves with all the other animal species and whatnot. So it's looking back on that knowledge and how humans became aware of observing their environment, then starting to formulate questions, and then more observations, trial and error. And that's how all of our evolution came, how we discovered fire, how to make fire. We saw it in nature, and we eventually learned how to create it. Hunting, we needed food and water. That's the basic part of the Abraham Maslow needs hierarchy.
Yep.
Oxygen, water, and food. So the oxygen, well, thanks to our trees and our plants, that supplied us. The food and water, we had to learn how to sustenance for us to be able to survive. So those became instinctive, hardwired. I use the word cognitivity a lot. Those are cemented into our basic brain core center. And then as we evolved, we were able to develop new processes, new ways of looking at nature, and then the emergence of, and this is a very important one too, to go through, and this is just a recent phenomenon, the how humans looked at nature pre-Neolithic. You're talking upper and middle Paleolithic, and this is evidenced by are the symbolic representations, the forms and platforms of communication that human beings developed, whether it's from cave art or pottery or building architecture or body art, amongst the various forms of expression and communication. Humans back in Paleolithic times still observed nature as imposing, whereas to the point with the early representations, the early cave art and relics that they left, animals were kind of like a teeter-totter, like a seesaw. The animals, there was a period of animism where animals were divinely acknowledged and thought of by human beings as, well, deities of a sort.
Yeah.
But animals held power and control in nature. As humans developed, we became aware, more and more aware. Our brains physically grew and were able to develop new intelligences and whatnot, a historical intelligence, a specific technology intelligence and those things. But all through those times, nature was still imposing enough for us to where our early symbolic, our symbolism, our art represented the animal as a power and control compartment, so to speak. Human beings were subservient still to animals. We hunted them in small groups or whatever, but it took many, many iterations of technology advancements and then the learning of metallurgies and obtaining better natural resources. So it was only until the Neolithic, the beginning proto-Neolithic, to where this balance of nature's power and control mechanism started to change. All through human history, attitude and behaviors, as we have today, where our attitude for something is formed from observations that we may bring in the scientific methodology. Attitude cues are stimulated in our brains to where do we develop, process them using our brain's memories as further evidence or analysis.
Yeah.
Cut from that become our behaviors. Yeah. And that can happen in a conversation with another person. You're talking about a subject and they tell you information, you develop an attitude, and then a behavior response often comes from that. Not only in as an example, conversations with people, but experiences in nature where, you know, on the hunt, the great hunt, so to speak, as through time, attitudes and behaviors of human beings were always present since the time that our brains were just becoming aware of life and where all that existed was the instinctive core parts of our brain. So as we develop through that, the attitudes and behavior mechanism was always present. But what grew from that was as the Neolithic times started to happen, the great revolutions of thought and of socialization. And those were two of the biggest dimensions where people that were before, they were in small family, extended family groups. And that's still how they hunted and obtained food and things like that. They were able to develop social cultures. And from that was the conglomeration, the beginnings of urbanization, where we're larger and larger communities. But right at those times, now you've got a different picture of the power and control concept, which is expressed through the symbolism, the representations, the cave art, the rock art, And then the buildings, now there's going to be buildings made for ceremonial purposes, ritual, another social development, the ritual concept, yeah. And residences, permanent residences. And a lot of that was caused by nature and climatology and whatnot, as our climate and ecology became favorable. The food element was not as difficult to procure. Animals didn't have to migrate as far or as frequent.
Yeah.
Human beings didn't have to travel as far. And they also then, the growing conditions became favorable for more agriculture. So all of those things fell into place to where the sedentary lifestyle became more and more prevalent. But my overarching point here, power and control, that's where humans, as expressed in the symbolism, started to take more power and control over nature, the environment, and other animals. And as you see, as for the dated symbolisms and that, you see the size of the animals becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. Mm. And first represented with more and more human beings in a hunting mode, but then those human beings become larger and larger and larger and larger, yeah. To the point where when the Neolithics, after the pre-pottery stages had already passed through time, humans were then perceived by themselves to be in power and control.
To be superior to the animals that were once larger than them, right. And scarier than them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what they had to hunt, they needed the groups to be able to hunt them. Their technologies weren't as developed enough. And then you throw in Mother Nature with the ecology and with, weather and climate and things like that. Those conditions had to become favorable for a lot of these things to have happened the way that they did. Yeah. So this is what I mean when I say hopefully that I can offer some information into the sources of how we became us through the mechanisms of attitude and behavior, which we still practice them today, power and control. Yep. Those were products of our ancestors.
Well, and that is something that we speak about so regularly on the show, Keith, is that concept of control, that concept of the push pull to fro of the mind and mentality, and even the idea that our brains are not only pattern searching machines looking for a pattern, because they'd much rather live in a rote pattern of hypnosis, just breathing for you or getting up and walking for you than actively having to fend for themselves or, you know, do something that requires hard survival again. You know, because we have gotten sedentary, but we're programmed on these millennia of quite literally panic responses to stimuli in the world around us, you know, that lead to anxiety, all kinds of things that we know of individually. But when you look at it as a far-reaching societal issue, it's massive. It's massive. The idea that so many people are caught on a point of panic and standing on a point of panic, you know, when it comes to facing something larger than, like you're saying, unfortunately, I think we have gotten back to a very primordial point of view where now the animal is bigger than us again, Keith. You know,
I'd like to throw out to you. I totally agree with that. But do you think that the animal today? I've thought about this for a while. That the animal today now, the imposing animal, power and control is the computer.
Could be. You know, interestingly enough, I just did a very large archiving project, and amongst that, sat through probably close to about 40 hours of news footage from Heaven's Gate. And okay. It was very fascinating. Now, this case happened in 1997. You know, not the beginning of the internet, but the beginning of the internet as we know it. You know, where it's like a scrollable web page, things like that. It was the beginning of online shopping, all that kind of stuff. And to hear all of this news footage, all of the sociologists talking about these people who are so easily persuaded because all of their friends are online. They don't know how to filter fact from reality. Like these were quite literally societal issues that were coming up in 1997 regarding the internet, and we're still having them 30 years later. We're still having the same issues of people being able to filter fact from fiction on the internet, people being drawn in through you know, predatory action on the internet in order to gain clicks or time. People being radicalized by the internet and radical mentalities spreading across the internet rapidly. So, it was very interesting to see that very early window into quite literally a situation that we deal with on a regular basis now, but it's the exact same problem. And there has been zero progress on the issue 30 years later. Yeah. Zero progress as far as being able to disseminate the average person being able to disseminate fact from fiction on the internet.
Oh, you know? I would even offer that it's actually gotten worse in 30 years maybe another example of a ritual culture that our ancestors in the early Neolithic, it was a new phenomenon to them.
Yeah.
The worship, spiritualism, the development of a proto religion. I mean, at least today we have a lot more knowledge in and understanding to know a lot more about how nature works. Back then, they didn't have those things. So this new collection of social bonding, so to speak, the inherent introduction of politics of a particular community. I mean, when you get a ritual culture, you have to build temples, and then you have the development or the creation of leaders and the power and controls culture.
Yeah.
To where as the community grows larger, you have to now, that's more complex. You have to start thinking about things like labor industries and food collection, building, they didn't have the knowledge that we do know about nature. So when they look up at the sky at day or night or whatever, and they look around them in nature, they still thought that animals were gods, that the Milky Way was heaven and hell.
Yeah.
That the sun was a god, in many cultures. The moon was a goddess in many cultures.
Yeah.
And, these entrepreneurial types, the leader types, developed the mindset to where, hey, this could be an awesome power and control mechanism. So when you try, as I smile here and I try and fit the computer proliferation into the mindset. And I mean, again, my point is I'm trying to portray that our intelligence, our mindset, our cognitivity today, we have to start thanking our ancestors, and it really hasn't changed. You brought up patterns and cycles.
Yeah,
that was the most basic, the awareness period, the awareness epoch of our evolution was when our instinctive brain started growing out into more lobes. We became aware of the patterns and cycles of nature. And with that, the inherent mathematics and geometry that nature also has laid out and provided for us. And they needed a mathematical language. Again, language is a tool for the symbolic representations or whatnot, but the intuitiveness, they had that. And they developed it all along, and the processes of awareness and patterns and behaviors was what started to shape advancements of our species, so to speak, and the development. Sure. And you know, it's not, and I make this point very often. You know, a lot of people have the thought process that it's an instantaneous type of a thing. When you talk about events and things like that, you know, like, oh, a comet ended the last ice age or whatnot. You got to remember that we're talking about time frames here of potentially hundreds of thousands or millions of years. So it's not like to say that our brains grew in 6 months.
Well,
you know, it's.
Even to think, and this is the noodle scratcher here, folks, even to think that time for a Cro-Magnon person was the same elapsed time as ours. We gave time, like we modernly gave time its definition, and it's 60 seconds to a minute. Like, time is totally different to the observer. You go to the moon, you need a totally different clock to stay on central time. Totally different type of clock if you're on the moon, you know. So it's one of the only things that is actively made up in science. It's the only part of physics that's just total bunk is time.
And our biology is based on the circadian rhythm and whatnot. So yeah, when you leave Earth, you know, Mars, well, you've got an extra hour in there going on every day, and it's going to be different. So that's just right. Another, you know, something to learn or whatever. But,
even the idea that though 10,000 years ago, somebody that lived in Texas, where I live right now, experienced time in the same way. You know, because it is conceptualized, you know, we have different concepts of time between the two of us.
But the pattern and the cycle of the sun rising, setting, and the moon, that was one of the most basic observed cycles in what I call the awareness epoch of Homo sapien. We weren't even sapien yet.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'll give us credit for being Homo, but you could even go back Cro-Magnon. They observed those most basic patterns in nature.
Well, and it's because they were necessary, Keith, as opposed to now. Most people couldn't tell you where the sun's going to rise or an approximation of it. Unless they hunted or fished or planted things nowadays, you know, and even quite a bit of that is done digitally now. But that was because we needed that to live. If you didn't know what the rising of Orion in the fall sky meant, you know, you didn't know where to go hunt. You starved during the winter. You didn't know that winter was coming, that you needed to pull crop out of the ground and get ready. You know, these were things
that plants.
Yeah. These things are quite literally the observations that led to success in life, just in general. So yeah, like they intimately knew the sun, the moon, its course during the day, the way that it affected the world around them, the stars at night, and how they guided them to different animals, to different areas to graze in during the year, all of that.
Yep. All part of the what I call the awareness epoch of our progenitor species.
Now,
to where those then became hard. Those are hardwired. Those are part of our basic brain structure. And as time went on, more and more things that we learned eventually became instinctive, to where our brain just kept growing, growing, growing to where it is now. And, you know, in a physical sense, if you project that out 100,000 years or whatever, you know, does our brain keep growing? And then do we end up looking like E.T. with the expanded head and whatnot? Yeah. So, I mean, you can take that out.
And you know, that it, with 20 minutes left here, Keith, that kind of brings us to a question, of course, of that preparedness for communication. Is it the fact that because we are no longer in sync with these things, because we're no longer in sync with literally the planet that we live on, the world around us, our place in the world around us, it seems to me like that would be key to the conversation, you know, that if we weren't grounded in ourselves as a society and as a humanity and understand the universal need for these things, you know, how important is it for us to get back to that point of human simplicity as a society so that we can have the greater intergalactic conversation? Is that the case, that we have to kind of regress ourselves as a society, so to speak?
Holism, cosmology, you know, these terms are in the dictionary.
Yeah.
But I don't think we really think about them much.
Sadly.
The new perspective that was offered by all of the astronauts, I'm trying to think of what the term was, when an astronaut would blast off and go into orbit, the new perspective of the Earth looking down on Earth, as opposed to just looking up in the sky and seeing a very, very sensitive, very alive organism, so to speak. And it was for literally all the astronauts and cosmonauts that have been fortunate enough to leave or get into Earth's orbit or leave it. It's transformational to their lives. Then the concepts of holism and awareness and cosmology and acknowledgement that you know, it's a big universe out there and whatnot, those things seem to come back. So we have definitions for them, but we're not we're so what's the gen term? Rabbit holes. We're all in our own individual rabbit holes to where we have no sense of either want, desire, or probably even knowledge of being able to hold our environment as extremely important to us. And I'm not ragging in this conversation. I'm not ragging on computers, but you know, if you want, one wants to look into different causes or whatever, again, holism is looking around you into your environment and whatnot. Well, a computer is a tool, an instrument, where you're just looking down into something. So that's all that I mean by that. But
sure.
I'm not.
Well,
I won't take that any farther.
Well, no, it's the fact of, you know, what is the tool being used for? You know, if it's being used to help research cures for cancer. And that's just it. Like, I speak pretty regularly now on behalf of Curious Research on shows. And I remind people, don't forget, the internet was not originally made for cat videos. And not even for shows like this, Keith. It was made for research. It was made so that MIT could talk in real time to Caltech, so that those scientists could talk and share data in real time for science, for the growth of humanity. It wasn't made for entertainment. It's what it became, but that's not what it was made for. That wasn't the vision of the internet. The vision of the internet was free, open sharing of research for the growth of humanity. And look at where it's come to. So it can be an amazing tool when used properly, you know, and that's just it. Like, it's an amazing resource
when learning used how to use it.
When used properly and responsibly. You know,
absolutely.
A hammer's a great tool. Don't go just swinging it around in a crowd. There's no good going to come of that. You know,
yeah, good analogy. I like that. That's absolutely the computer can.
Yeah,
it opens up so many avenues.
Absolutely.
But we just have to direct it.
That's just it, you know, and even right now, the conversation of humanity, Keith, the idea that I'm with you, I don't think as a humanity, despite the fact that we have an intergalactic representative at the UN, folks, just so you are aware, there is an intergalactic representative at the UN ready to greet something if it lands a la Gort style, you know.
Gary Hessel type.
As a humanity, we have no universal representation. We have no universal, I don't even think, motive of being or mode of being, you know. We are so on so many parts of the world, antithesis to each other and what we believe and what we stand for. It's fascinating, Keith. So I guess the question is, how do we handle this? Because it's happening. It's not gonna happen. So how do we handle it when it does happen?
Yeah, that's present some difficulties. I think, at least in the U.S., I've seen in the last generation, the polarization of the political process. Has accelerated by example. Maybe has that happened in other parts of the world, but what I mean by that is that when we talk about a conjoining or an advancement of the human thought to where we can then now become and live our lives more holistically, more with a recognition of cosmology and not trying to physically destroy our planet, deforestation and the economic aspects of that. But you bring up and a lot of people, I think their thoughts go very quickly to the concept of globalization.
Yeah.
And that's why I mentioned politics just a few seconds ago, in that that's people somehow have this connection. Oh, my God, it's got to be politics. You know, globalization has got to be a world politic or something. And that's a difficult argument to try and reconcile. That's not easy.
No, it isn't. I'll be honest. I'm not one for a globalist agenda. I don't think that there is overall that kind of globalist agenda the way that people truly think. I think that there are some globalization initiatives out there. But is there an overall, I just don't think that there's an overall like maniacal specter over the globe trying with strings attached to everything. I don't think that that's the case. I think that we have a lot more free say in what goes on in the world around us and in our active involvement in the world around us, Keith. I think it's very Fight Club, the aspect of you choose your level of involvement, you know. Go ahead.
I think that's a fear that people have.
Yes, absolutely.
That probably huge a majority fear. Is that when they hear that word or that concept, it's oh no, my God, that's no, we can't have that. It's got to be, we got to have a democracy, or we got to have a theocracy or whatever.
Yeah.
It's all we got to separate the word political away from globalization and hopefully find the course to where people, nations can be autonomous.
Yeah.
But have also the thought process where things on a global basis, in other words, the physical things where, you know, we're destroying our forests and climate change and things like that. You know, we're all responsible for it.
And, that's right.
And I think human beings have had a significant input into the climate change phenomena. So we have to be, one, all of us willing to accept that this phenomenon is being caused by us and that we have to take steps to change that. So that's an example of a global basis phenomenon that we have to come together to be able to.
And and politically, you've got to be able to put your politics aside. You've got to be able to say that whether you believe in, quote, global warming as put forth by the media or not, folks, to say that humanity and our technology does not impact the world around us is silly. I want you to stop using lithium today. Today. If that is what you believe, that you have zero impact, stop using lithium right now. All mobile devices, anything with a lithium, that means your computer, because it has a lithium battery in it, every bit of it, stop using it, because you don't believe it has an impact. You know, it does. We have an impact on the world around us. And yes, we need to get a global aspect on that. We need to begin to realize that while AI is scary in some rights, Keith, you know, the one thing I tell people regularly on this show is that, make no mistake, it will be as smart as the average person reading the internet, because it's pulling its data from the internet most of the time. So take that as scary as you want. Like, that could be great, that could be horrible, that it's going to be as smart as the average person reading the internet. However, when given specific data pools to go through, a prime example would be last year, in January, the Microsoft AI found almost 10,000 viable replacements for lithium, organic compounds. It did almost 10 years of hard lab research in one day. In one day, found 10,000 viable organic compounds that could replace lithium. So these are the possibilities. Like, you could say AI is horrible, but at the same time, AI can find things on a rate faster than we could. So the fact that we could get lithium out of the marketplace and stop strip mining the earth for this horribly toxic chemical to run our devices, that's pretty awesome. That's a 10-year leap head start on that technology. You know?
Yep.
So that's great. Those are beautiful things that, yes, we can take the future and apply it in this kind of way to a global mentality that isn't a globalist regime as people think, but an idea of how to greater represent ourselves as a humanity and as a planet.
Yeah, and as you're saying that, the word just came up to me, weaponization. It just seems that a new technology, and you know, we've got to say AI is the current
absolutely
one. It's weaponization is the proto. How do I put this? Proto. It's the pioneer, so to speak. When the technology is weaponized and then goes through a process and then gets rolled out into the general public, and then you can branch off into more beneficial. But it's that I don't know if it's part of the human instinctual psyche, but weaponization
It's so funny. One of the videos that we play regularly whenever we have Mike Turber from 5x5 News on is a video quite literally from Lockheed Skunk Works branded with the Skunk Works logo and everything. And it's this young scientist talking about this nuclear reactor behind him that's about the size of the room that I'm sitting in, you know? And he's like, we can 2-3 generation this every year. Like, by the time we're done with this, I'm going to need a new job.
And now
there is actively the patent out there from Lockheed Martin for a nuclear reactor that fits inside of an F-16.
Wow.
So you're talking about something the size of a V-8 engine that is a nuclear reactor.
And it's now portable.
They made it the size of a room, and within 3-4 years, like, generationed that down that many times. So that's the world of technology that we're living in, that, yes, you know, we're looking right now at fusion being a real possibility, you know, and free power for all, if the powers that be will let that happen. So that's the question, is once again the weaponization of things, because that's what they said in the Lockheed Martin video, is, well, of course, you know, it's going to be used for all these things, for battlefield purposes first, and then it'll be coming to your home, like, it'll be available, you know. But it's like, of course it's going into our weapons platforms to begin with.
Let's test it out. Sounds like another iteration of attitude, behavior, power, and control.
And that's just it. It's the fact of we as a humanity have to be willing to work together, Keith, and not have that paradigm of control, not have that paradigm of want to be right necessarily. And it's hard. I cannot wait to read your new work whenever it comes out. You are furiously working on that right now. You have some appearances coming up in October. Let us know about those real quick before we let you go.
Okay. I'll be first weekend of October up in Harris, Michigan, Upper Peninsula by Marquette, ancient archaeology conference. I'll be speaking there live. And then a couple weekends later in Baltimore at the 25th anniversary edition of the Mysteries of Space and Sky Conference. So wow. I'll be doing lectures on Native America and actually a couple of worldwide cultures, some recent discoveries and patterns that I've put together. From that, I talk about Serpent Mound, Cahokia, in Göbekli Tepe, Karahan, which I had the fortunate experience of expedition there last year or so. And incidentally, the timing on that was pretty good, because the Turkish government, in cooperation with Istanbul University, who has a legal domain on some of those sites, Karahan and whatnot, they have shut down the tourism aspects of most of that. So, you could spin off into political reasons or whatnot. Face it, tourism is a very, very economic driven engine. I wouldn't say absolutely for the Turkish government, as opposed to maybe Egypt, but that gets in the way of knowledge progress. When tourists, you know,
it can, you know, and that's one of the things that we say regularly about the science of Egyptology, things like that, is how much of that is based on tourism, you know, because when you start getting into the actualities of the pyramids and there is no way they're a tomb. I'm sorry. By everything that Egyptology says, there are no sacred scriptures there to get a soul weighed at the end of life or anything like that. So I can't buy the fact that they're a tomb, as Egyptology says.
But if they can keep the tourism itinerary going,
that's it.
That's what they're doing.
That's it.
I, I would think the Turkish government is not stepping wholesale into that, but nevertheless, fellow researchers this year have been shut out.
Yeah,
there's just not much going on there. So for the time being. So
I heard about a few canceled trips from folks that were supposed to be going over there. So I'm sorry to hear that for them. Let everybody know where they can go to keep up with your research, where they can go to get their copy of the Humaniverse guides, all that kind of good stuff, Keith.
Okay, yeah, the books are always available on all of the digital platforms and bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Apple. And we're making those available. We're doing final touches on my website, the Humaniverse. Awesome. You got that up there. So we're putting some final touches on that. So you can follow my updates and appearances and whatnot through that. I've done a couple of YouTube interviews, so we'll have to get those up there. And then cool. I also, too, this isn't until next year, May, June, but I'll be part of another expedition with my friend Dr. Robert Schock of Boston University.
Awesome.
We'll be going down to Peru and Bolivia and Nazca, flying over, and the cargo cults with all of that, and doing some digging and some explorations there. So
cool.
That and just writing away on the manuscript. I hope to have that done by the end of the year anyways, rough draft for the publisher. And then we'll see what happens from that point.
Well, I greatly look forward to getting my copy of that. As always, I love your work. I love our conversation. Thank you so much for the time, Keith. Please do hold the line while we close things out with the audience.
All right, Chris.
While you are online checking out everything from Keith Seelan and the Humaniverse, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe, and share. That is where you can follow all of not only our channels on YouTube, but all of our guest channels are there on our videos page. When we come back from this commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by Dr. Angela Thompson Smith to talk about the world of remote viewing, what that is, and how you can practice it yourself. We'll be getting into that right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and thank you for hanging on through that quick break. Thank you so much also to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. They are my source for CBD. Many years ago, when I first got diagnosed with travel anxiety, things like that, my doctor was like, you know, maybe you should try some CBD. And that began my search, and I found Christopher Lynch from True Hemp Science. His product is absolutely amazing. Awesome terpene profiles, fantastic products. Stop on by and check them out. Curious7 is the code that you want to use at TrueHemScience.com to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two, count them, two free edibles on your way out the door as well. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Dr. Angela Thompson Smith. She is the founder of MindWise Consulting, and she is also the author of the book Tactical Remote Viewing. We have had her on the show before. We've spoken to her numerous times at the International Remote Viewing Conferences. She will be at the International Remote Viewing Conference 25th Anniversary Cruise coming up, folks. So if you are going to that, like Curious Realm is, you will be able to see her there speaking. So welcome back to the show. Doctor, how are you today?
I am fine. Thank you. And thank you for having me back on the show.
I love our conversations because you are hands down one of the people that is highly, highly respected in the field of remote viewing. There are quite a few names out there, but when it comes to practicing remote viewing, you and MindWise Consulting are tops of the list. And your many, many years of work, Angela, how did you come to the world of remote viewing to begin with? Because you actively had some paranormal experiences when you were younger, things like that. How did you come to separate that from remote viewing?
Well, I was always an intuitive child, you know, my mother would always put it down to a great imagination, even when I gave her information that was proved to be right, you know, as parents do. And I had out-of-body experiences from a very young child where I would just go off and float around the neighborhood and go visit people like my grandmother in her home. Nobody saw me, you know, but I saw lots of stuff that I was able to confirm. So, and when I told my mother about it, she said, well, everybody dreams. I said, but Mom, I'm still awake. And she said, oh, it's just your imagination. In England, things were a lot more tolerated, the paranormal stuff. And it wasn't until I came to the States and I found the paper that had been written in 72 by Puthoff and Targ, the first scientific documentation of their remote viewing studies. And I read it and it was like, wow, this is really interesting. It's kind of what I do, but I've always done mine, you know, sort of when I've been very relaxed on my own rather than with a scientific team. And I wrote to the PEAR Lab because I also had some papers from the PEAR Lab, Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab, that's closed down now. And they said, oh, when you're this way, come and visit us. So it happened that I was working in medical research and in New Jersey, and when I'd come over to live in the States, and I thought I was invited down and invited to be a volunteer at PEAR. And that's when I heard about remote viewing in a very practical sense.
And specifically remote viewing, once you saw it, like you said, it was something that you had experienced previously, but for you it was out of body experience. How do you akin the two now? Do you still see them as a variance on each other? Does one depend on the other for you, Angela?
The orthodox remote viewing teachers disclaim OBE, out-of-body experience, sure, as being remote viewing. But when you look back at Puthoff and Targ's original paper, what they wrote was that what we used to call OBE, traveling clairvoyance, intuition, et cetera, we are now calling remote viewing, and that was coined by Ingo Swann and Hal Puthoff, as a term that doesn't have any baggage with it, basically, because they wanted something, a scientific term. They were doing scientific research. They referred to it as remote perception rather than remote viewing.
Okay. Okay. And I can see how that would be very much the akin to relabeling UFO to UAP so that science would be willing to finally look at a situation. And that is a, interestingly enough, when it comes to paranormal research, when it comes to parapsychical research specifically, the data for remote viewing is there. It is pretty hands down. And I've had my own experiences with remote viewing. I've only had a few, I would say, good sessions. But out of the 8 or 9 sessions that I've done, I've had 3 sessions that were like a lot of hit.
Yeah. This couple in India that I was training this past weekend, they started off very cautiously, of course, because they were total beginners. But over, you know, the practice with the protocols, they were hitting their targets. That one was a farm in Afghanistan where they were using desalinated water to grow crops, and she actually got the farm and the location described beautifully, including water, which I asked her to taste, and she said it tastes salty. You know, so it's amazing. The protocols, it's not just CRV, the controlled remote viewing, which is, you know, we also call the military method.
Yeah.
Because I did a lot of work with it. But there's ERV, which is more the extended remote viewing, which is kind of like OBE, but more controlled. And of course, all the other variations that have arisen since the originals were developed.
And you are working, because you do work with a lot of beginners in this field. You have classes that you quite literally craft to the person. It's pretty fascinating. How do you begin with an utter beginner, Angela, who let's say has never really had a propensity for clairvoyance, never really had premonition of anything that they can recall in their life, no true moments of synchronicity that they can account for?
I would estimate that about 60% of my students are newbies, people who claim to be, you know, have some intuition, but they've never actually formally trained in anything. But there are some others that come in that have had training with others, and they want to expand, you know, and try some new protocol perhaps from a different angle. Because what I focus on is applications. I'm not just teaching you how to do it, but how to use it. So on the third day of class, we spend all day tackling a real life target, such as the moon rover, you know, or one of the moon rovers. I would choose one and task that. And they're blind tasked, which means they don't have any upfront information to begin with. But as they go through the day during sessions, they gradually acquire more and more information and work as a team. Because I have up to three or four students in a class. They work as a team on Sunday, actually working a case. And that's very satisfying.
And when you say working a case, how do you begin that process of working a case?
Okay, well, I usually choose something that's current. You know, I try not to bring in politics or anything personal with me or anything with COVID when we were going through the COVID thing, because that's just, you know, too topical.
Yeah.
But up in Seattle, they had some sit-ins and things in the city center for causes, you know, about local causes that were in the news at that time when I was having a class. So I chose that as their target. And I pick a coordinate or a case number, random numbers and random letters that only applies to that target. So I go in and get, I have two random programs, a random number and a random letter. So it's like ABC123. So that's their, called the coordinate or the tasking number for that particular project. Then on Sunday, they come in and fresh from doing 2 days of bringing them up to speed with the protocols. And they do their first session of three in the morning, where they just go, they just do stage one or phase one, as Lynn refers to it, and make sure that all the students are on the same page. They're all looking at the same target, which happens, at least three of them are right on, you know, giving the correct, what we call gestalt. Is this an event, or is this land, water, air, man-made, etc., biological, etc. Then they take a break, come back, and they do a second session, which they're doing solo by now. I take them up to stage four, and I ask them, I say, your gestalts are correct. These are correct. That this is just, for example, land, air, and water. So tell me more about that land, air, and water. So they go in then by themselves. They're doing solo sessions. In different I have students in different countries doing this, and we're working as a team, which is mind-blowing, And then they come back with their data, and they read out their data to me. I document it on white sheets of paper. Normally, if I have in-person classes, the students write up their own data.
Sure.
Over Zoom, you have to do something a little different. So by the second session, they're really getting into it. And they come together after we've got all the data, and they do a little bit of analysis. So they become analysts for the data. And then taking that, then they go away. And usually I have a non-leading question for the third session, where they go right up to stage six, phase six. And usually it's something like, the target is a meeting with individuals. What would be the resulting outcome of that meeting? Something like that. Because they will have already known that there was a meeting. There was already people there. So I work with data they already have, not giving them anything new.
Interesting. But,
give me new data. And they come back after the third one, then we do the same process.
And through this process, you basically can not only hone the data that's coming in, but also figure out who amongst the group is better at spotting different gestalts, correct?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes you usually get somebody that's just spot on. When we did the Notre Dame fire, one student actually said a church. And another student actually said fire during their session. So, but I don't, I'm not in the position where I'm picking out people who are good at it, because they go back into their own community and then join up with others, you know, to do remote viewing. But if they're really good, then sometimes I'll ask them if they want to be part of the Nevada remote viewing group. And this is a group of volunteers that I call on when we have urgent cases to work.
And you work with all kinds of groups, not just civil groups and private engineering groups, but police, all kinds of people, Angela.
Absolutely. I've done everything super nuts. In fact, we were just working a case, a very sad case. I can't tell you too many details, but in a foreign country, there was a five-year-old abducted by child traffickers. So we were trying I and two of my best male viewers were trying, there's female, good female viewers too, let me add, to try and track down the location and the perpetrators. And we were able to get a lot of very usable information, but we had to back out because the situation was getting too dangerous for the people who were there on the ground.
And speaking of dangers, are there any dangers on behalf of the remote viewer? Because of course, whenever we've had Lynn Buchanan on, you know, he's always warned that, you know, everybody wants to be able to help find missing children or, you know, help solve murder cases, but you know, you may not want this lurking around. Eventually,
right, and you know. Yeah, we teach detoxing. So if they're,
how does that work?
Yeah, if they're working a case that might make them feel uncomfortable, and even after a case, sometimes some of the students complained of a headache or feeling anxious or their heart's beating. We teach how to let go of that data and recognize that the data is not you; that it's outside of yourself. And you are just an observer of the data. So there are certain techniques to let go of that. It's called detoxing of that data.
And as an anxiety sufferer myself, I can definitely say there have been times whenever I've been in session doing remote viewing where, yes, I feel very worked up and have to step away, have to move away from it. And it's hard to come back to it, because of the way that energy can hit you and impact you. And it's interesting because I wouldn't even say, Angela, that I'm doing any kind of, I guess, necessarily active remote viewing. Most of what I'm doing, I guess, I would look at more as passive, where I am observing things, watching things, not trying to poke or prod, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah. And on the whole, you know, practice targets are meant to be very neutral. But when you get into actual operational work, you do come across some situations that can be a little, the modern word is triggering. and I don't try not to use that because it'll come and go, as you know. But there are, and I'll tell you a funny story. When I was training with Lynn, because I trained with Lynn and Paul Smith. So I did one target with Lynn and one of his graduate students. This was at his location in Alamogordo, New Mexico. And then he gave me another one. He said, just do this one. And he gave me an envelope with the picture inside, target picture, which was sealed with just the coordinate number on the front. So I sat down in a corner there with my paper and pen, and I started working through it. And I got that there was, as I got more and more data, it was appearing as that this was an animal up a tree and was being beaten. And I thought, Lynn wouldn't give me a target like that. I was starting to get very anxious about it. But I worked it through to the end. And I took the paper to him in my session and I said, Lynn, what did you give me? He said, oh, it's just a regular target. And I said, well, I'm getting very, very anxious here about this target. And I said, I'm getting that there's this animal and it's tied up with a rope to a tree and it's being beaten by a young Asian boy. And so I said, I need to open it and get the feedback, please. And what it was a children's party with a little Asian boy beating a pinata in a tree.
Oh, my God. Oh, my gosh. I remember very distinctly when I was given my first target by my monitor, she sent me coordinate. That was it, via text message, and I immediately saw white truss what we use in my industry to fly lights to ceilings, things like that. What you would see in like a communications tower, you know. And that, of course, became something that we wrote down, everything else. And sure enough, one of my first targets was involving white truss. It was pretty phenomenal how it just kind of came to me. How frequent is it that, what is the difference for you, I guess, of frequency between having to work for result or result just happening and manifesting, Angela?
Usually during my sessions, I have no idea what I'm getting. I try not to analyze the data as I'm getting it, just acquire the data and write it down and sketch and write and without analyzing, because we're trying to keep mental noise, that logical brain that wants to solve everything out of the picture by writing and saying all the data, occupying that venue there. Most of the time I have no idea. And I write up the session, and very often I'm surprised at what I get. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I get a real strong, particularly if I'm doing it with a monitor. Maybe I'm picking it up a little bit from them, but I like to work with everybody blind, with not knowing the target. So sometimes I'll kind of intuit what the target is from the data I'm getting, but I try not to analyze as I'm working, saying, oh, it must be this or it must be that, because that's where you get what we call off signal line.
Yeah.
You got getting into imagination.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It can be, like you said, you definitely don't want to corrupt the data as it's coming through with your preconceived notion of something.
Right.
It's a real interesting kind of dissociative process that you have to go through to kind of stream of conscious, let that stuff come through.
Right. Listen to the subconscious.
It's pretty interesting, and it can be a hard place to get to. How do you help beginning students get past that barrier of kind of letting the monkey mind run free?
Yeah, I give them an opportunity at the beginning of each session, each practice session, to either do a little meditation or listen maybe to hemi-sync tones from Monroe Institute, or say a prayer that makes them feel calm. But anything to get into that right brain state. I call it getting in the zone for myself. Because I've trained in Buddhism, and I've trained in shamanism, and as well as remote viewing and paranormal stuff. So I can easily sit down and in a few minutes get into that stage or that phase or point where I'm, detached.
Yeah.
And then I know when it is, and then I can sit down with a pen and paper and just work through it and stay focused.
And at what point do you begin that, I guess, not the detachment, but at what point do you begin being able to be an open channel for that information without corrupting it, Angela?
Just don't judge. I can recognize when I'm getting into what we call AOL drive, which is AOL is where your left brain starts to interpret the data, but doesn't have sufficient information because you're getting little bits of information at a time. And it suddenly gives you a picture and you go, oh, and you have to put that off to the side of your paper CRV is called analytical overlay or AOL. So you have to put that down and say, that's not data. That's not my data, and get back into your session. So there are ways of dealing with noise, mental noise that comes through where you do start going off at a tangent. trying to make sense of the data.
And how does this process differentiate from, let's say, the process of beginning an out-of-body experience? Or how does it differentiate from lucid dreaming?
There are similarities, but they're not the same. That's how I try and phrase it, because OBE is very much, there's a lot of bilocation involved, whereas bilocation is feeling that you're in two places at the same time and being able to observe what's happening in two places at one time, where you are and then where your consciousness is. In remote viewing, that's sort of discouraged. Lynn will say it's okay to a point. Paul actively discourages it. And particularly if the students are sitting there with their eyes closed for any point, any length of time, you know, it's like, come back, stay with your process, stay with the process. That's what I say. They're basically the same goals, to acquire information, but through a different process.
Interesting. And, you know, once again, the idea that kind of like what Lynn says, anybody can be taught to remote view. It's a martial art. It's a mental martial art. And the idea that you do not have to be a clairvoyant person in order to practice controlled remote viewing, specifically controlled remote viewing, the military CRV style.
Yeah, the more formal training. Yeah.
Which is what I've been studying. I think it's a great launching off point where you get to understand a lot of the basic underpinnings that are used with various other versions of remote viewing.
Right. Yeah. And it's a very interesting process, because it takes you through stages that give you increasing amounts and levels of knowledge about the target that you then say and write. You know, you say your data so that your monitor or even your own subconscious knows that it's got the data, and then writing it down. And that whole process just brings up that all that data from the subconscious, so you can record it and hit the target.
how do you begin to, I guess, record hits, misses, things like that, Angela? How do you, because everybody's method is kind of, I guess, different. Lynn has a very specific method with how things are recorded in his CRV method. But how do you go about recording hits, misses, things like that for your work?
There are a couple of evaluation methods. Of course, Lynn's, which says how many corrects against how many uncorrects, and percentage. And he's done it very precisely and scientifically. So you can get a percentage. And then what Paul uses it, and some of the others, is the TARG scale. Russell Targ developed a 7-point scale, which is readily available. I can share that with anybody who wants to contact me. Because it's he's put it out there into the world. You can use a ranking system, to rank your data, rank your hits and misses. I really like the TARG scale. The very top one, the 7, is that you've named the target and you've given enough information that somebody could recognize that that was that target. Down to the 1, which is, you know, you're just getting a bit of data, but nothing much to recognize the target. My students, I was evaluating my students on the TARG scale for some time. I don't now. I just let them do it. And they were averaged, the The beginners were averaging about 5 on the TARG scale. The people who'd done training before were averaging about 6. And then about 5, you know, overall.
Now let's... let's take our conversation kind of aside. It's not necessarily a sidestep, because I'd love to say that that remote viewing doesn't lie within the world of the quote paranormal, but it does. And to see, especially now, so many remote viewers working with paranormal investigation teams. I know of a few remote viewers that are working with cryptozoologists.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you fall when it comes to marrying the world of remote viewing with paranormal research, Angela?
I go where the need is. You know, if someone calls me up and says, "Hey, I'm a parapsychologist and I'm working with Bigfoot. I'm working on studies of Bigfoot. Can I give you a project? Can I give you a target?" Sometimes I can work everything from double blind up to fully front loaded, because I look for new information, unknown information when I'm remote viewing. So it doesn't matter if I have a little bit of upfront information. And that's allowed in applications work. It's not in research or training, but in applications you can do that. So I will work with most, I have turned down some projects in the past, but I'm just curious about how remote viewing can be applied to all different types of projects.
And have you had any paranormal projects that you have been tasked with? Anything you can talk about anyway?
I'm just trying to think. Like haunted buildings. I know a couple of times in the past I've been contacted and asked about a particular building or a structure, and asked about, you know, what's going on here. And so I will also use a couple of esoteric tools when I do that, like the runes, the rune stones.
Interesting.
And I have an app. It's called Ghost Radar. It has a lexicon of words in it. And I'll give you an example of how I've used Ghost Radar.
Please.
I believe it was last Thanksgiving, I was contacted by a friend whose neighbor's son, adult son, hadn't come home for Thanksgiving. And they planned, you know, for him to be there. They knew he went to a party the night before, but then silence. They had no idea where he was. So they asked me to do the session. So as I was doing a regular session, and then I ran the Ghost Radar for a bit, and it said water and dead as two of the words that came through from this lexicon of words that runs as the program runs. So I wrote it up, and I said, I'm sad to say that one of the deductions I'm making, you don't try not to make deductions, but one of the results from the remote viewing is that possibly this young man is passed and he's in water somewhere. And it turned out that this young man had attended a party the night before and left and walked back to his vehicle, was attacked and was killed and thrown into the river, was where he found his body.
Wow.
So I have no problem with using esoteric tools when I'm working remote viewing.
And I ask because, I would think that the two almost go hand in hand, and it was interesting last year at the remote viewing conference to see I'm trying to remember who it was who came in and spoke about it was Joshua from Hope Paranormal came in and spoke about using remote viewing in paranormal work. And it was interesting to hear that. And I'd seen numerous communities online where people were viewing very specific instances of cryptid attacks, things like that. And I don't know what to make of that myself. But
well, it's always every or remote viewing is speculative.
Yes.
Because until you get feedback, you don't know what you've got, and you just get the data and send it off. And sometimes you have to wait years for, like with the rings, when I did the Rings of Saturn project back in 94, I had to wait until I know it wasn't an anomalous one, but I had to wait until the Cassini probe had got to Saturn and sent back information before I got feedback. But I believe that there is feedback available for almost all remote viewing. You just have to wait for it for a while.
And with that in mind, what has been the most interesting remote viewing project that you have been personally associated with, Angela?
I think the search for Amelia Earhart has been the most interesting for me over the years, because I was tasked it twice, once by an engineer back in the 1990s who was actually looking for her plane, the Electra, and also for her co-pilot, Fred Noonan. And where was she, where was he, and where was the plane? So basically he was just looking for the plane, but I got a lot of data which pointed to her being captured by the Japanese and imprisoned. I gave that to him and he said, well, that doesn't help me find the plane. Even I'd given him a lot of location data. And then many years later, I got tasked again. And I brought in other remote viewers now, the Nevada Remote Viewing Group, these volunteer groups. Sometimes we get some money to pay them. Other times they are just pro bono. They found out that, from the data that she was in, held by the Japanese, that's coming out now about it. They even drew the cells, the viewers even drew the cells which matched the cells on Saipan Island, where it was claimed she was held prisoner. Recently, we've had some insight into that because some researchers went to Washington, D.C. for the Navy archives and found documentation that said that they knew, the Navy knew, that she was a prisoner on Saipan Island and she probably died there.
Wow.
Yeah. I asked one of my ex-Army colleagues or Navy colleagues, I wonder why they didn't go and get her. If they knew she was a prisoner, why didn't they go get her? He said, because if they had let it be known that they had got that data, they'd broken the code, the Japanese code. Mm. That's what they knew. But if they'd let it be known that they'd done that, then the Japanese would probably just change the code.
Yeah.
And so they couldn't say anything. So she was basically sacrificed.
Oh, man. Wow. And once again, what an amazing trail of evidence to come across that started with remote viewing.
Yeah. And we've shared it. Of course, there are all the naysayers who say, no, she landed on somewhere or ditched her plane in the ocean. They're thinking now they found the plane about a mile down, but we don't know yet until they can get down there with ROVs and stuff.
Well, and it, you know, when it comes to evidence, when it comes to and capital E evidence, doctor, because that's one of the things that we stand on with this show is the idea that evidence should never be taken lightly. It should never be anything outside of what could exonerate you in court. You know, good proper data. And I will say all day long that out of any parapsychological study, remote viewing probably has more of that data than anything else.
I think so too. But on the other hand, remote viewing was never intended for that purpose. It was intended to supplement or provide additional data to what was already known, and maybe giving investigators the edge or some additional information to be able to solve the case.
Well, so, and you know, once again, there are numerous forms of remote viewing out there, CRV, ERV. When it comes to that, how do you recommend somebody find a course of study, doctor? How do you recommend somebody begin that journey?
Several ways. One, talk to people who've already done some training with different schools and see, find out what their experience has been. Also, do your homework. You know, go to websites. There's so much information out there. You know, because we've got training groups on Hawaii. There's training groups here in the States. Yeah. Training groups in Latin America now. Training groups in England. So do your homework and find one that is compatible to the way you access information. It's always good to be challenged, of course. But I think if you can go somewhere where you're more comfortable with the training, then and you're confident, and also ask about the trainers, you know, who trained the trainers.
And of course, you know, when it comes to finding a school, training with somebody, things like that, a lot of that comes to personal trust, you know, and looking up, like you're saying, doing your research, studying on somebody and the type of work that they do, you know.
Yeah.
So what advice do you have for anybody looking to further their education with new types of remote viewing?
I would point them first to IRVA, the International Remote Viewing Association, which I and a group of folks helped start in 1999. Their website, IRVA.org, has a wealth of information on remote viewing of all types. There's a new group come out now. It's called the Center Lane Project. It's really formed around the original remote viewing guys, the military guys, who didn't want Ingo's work to get lost in the shuffle. So it focuses mainly on CRV and Ingo and many of his. I'm doing a lot of book reviews for them of Ingo's books. And I didn't realize there were so many.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are sources out there. IRVA, there's the PA, there's SSE, lots of organizations you can go. And they all have varying levels of ranging from scientific to anecdotal evidence. I don't like to use the word evidence, but information about remote viewing and its uses.
Yeah, because there are, once again, tons of applications. And I think that's what's growing more and more than anything else right now, doctor, is the actual applications of remote viewing and the different industries that are beginning to apply remote viewing. How do you see things like AI taking part in remote viewing right now?
I used to feel very nervous about AI. And then recently, Cindy Miller, she gave us, gave IRVA members and others, two lessons, two classes in using AI with remote viewing. Mm-hmm. And they were very thorough, very detailed. And we tried a few in class, you know, going in, like you could use it for generating targets, use it for scoring targets, using it for generating creativity and creative ideas for remote viewing. And I feel a lot more comfortable now. I haven't actually gone over to using it, but I'm more comfortable with using it now if I decide I want to use it to generate targets. But she showed us how you can put in your session summary and ask AI, please produce a graphic or a picture target of this data.
And
you can refine it. You can say, limit it to these dates, limit it to this location. You know, so you narrow your parameters down a little bit. And it will come up with this wonderful picture generated from your data.
Interesting.
That amazed me.
Wow. And that is a fantastic use of AI for.
And then you can compare that picture then with the targets and see how close you got to the target.
Well, and, you know, for that comparison, and also one of my favorite AIs is SciSummary. I absolutely love it. It only pulls data from the pools that you give it. So let's say I wanted to do a scholarly research paper on liver enzymes. I could give it 85 articles on the internet.
Yeah.
Or PDFs from the National Institute of Health and feed them in there and have it give me 1,000-word summary with 5 bullet points.
Wow.
So, to be able to feed SciSummary even your repetitive data on a similar target, or if you're doing multiple sessions on the same target. You know, to be able to cull all that data together.
I think there's a lot of potential for it. It isn't always 100% accurate.
Sure. Well, and that's
remote viewing.
That's what I would kind of say about the SciSummary is that at that point it's literally only working off the data field that you're giving it. So it's not pulling anything. Like if you're giving it 5 days of repetitive data from viewing sessions, you could possibly find some really good nuggets in there that maybe even a good monitor missed out on.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely.
I need to do a bit more work on it myself.
it's something that as I pick up my remote viewing again, it's something I'm definitely going to be looking into because it sounds like it would be entirely too useful to be able to go through and just feed it multiple days of viewing on the same target, you know?
So, see what you get. I think there's a potential for it, a good potential for using it within remote viewing.
Yeah.
But I'm not quite there yet myself.
Yeah, well, we will see. And we will also see what comes of the upcoming cruise. So I can't wait. It's going to be super fun. I look forward to seeing you again in person. Thank you so much for taking the time today to sit back and just casually talk about a very deep, thick topic. You know, it's something that probably I would say of most. It's probably the topic that I get uncasually asked about more than anything else. I get casually asked about UFO research and things like that all the time, but when it comes to a serious question from people, I think remote viewing is probably one of the most serious ones that I get, where people truly have a deep-seated curiosity about it when they ask about it. So thank you so much for taking the time to come on and help demystify this topic for our audience, Angela.
Well, you're welcome. I always enjoy coming and chatting with you.
Let everybody know where they can go to find out more about your work, where they can go to buy your books, of course, other than our store, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, they can go to mindwiseconsulting.com. That's my website. And there's a fair bit about what I do there, but you know, I kind of limit it because I know people generally only look at one front page. I have two, so take a look at both of them. They can also contact me and with any questions or curiosity about remote viewing, go to IRVA.org, and lots of information there, lots of videos of past talks and conferences. I'm going to be giving a talk on 25 years of memories of remote viewing of IRVA, with lots of pictures. And you can also go to the Center Lane Project. That is a subscription website, but they do have some freebies there too about Ingo's work and the beginnings of controlled remote viewing and book reviews, etc.
Fantastic. Well, once again, thank you so much for the time. We greatly appreciate it. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out everything from Dr. Angela Thompson Smith and MindWise Consulting, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe, share. That's where you can find the show. That is where you can also find Curious Research and our brand new observation log. If you are a paranormal researcher out in the field, make sure to get your copy of the all new Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log to get all your data as it happens in real time. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in this evening. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. It is that makes the conversation possible. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.